behind you, gazing at you placidly as if to say, this was in doubt. So now it's a party. Yika meets you at the Overlook in half an hour. With her are four other Kastremans who are armed and dressed in faded colors and grays for camouflage upon the surface. It's a harder procession going up than it was coming down. Lots of uphill walking, many sets of stairs. You're not as out of breath as a few of Yika's crew by the time it's done. But then you've been walking miles every day while they've been living safe and comfy in their underground town. Yika, you notice, only breathes a little harder. She's keeping in shape. Eventually, though, you reach a false basement in one of the decoy houses topside. It's not the same basement that you entered through, which shouldn't surprise you. Of course, their gate has multiple entrances and exits. The underground passages are more complicated than you initially thought, though. Something important to keep in mind should you ever need to leave in a hurry. The decoy house has strong back sentries like the other one, some guarding the basement entrance, and some actually in the house upstairs, keeping watch on the road outside. When the upstairs sentries give you the all clear, you head out into the late evening ashfall. After what? Less than a day in Kastrima's geode? It's amazing how strange the surface seems to you. For the first time in weeks, you notice the sulfur stench of the air, the silvery haze, the incessant soft patter of fat ash flakes on the ground, and dead leaves. The silence, which makes you realize just how noisy Kastrima Under is, with people talking and pulleys squeaking and smithies clanking, and the omnipresent hum of the geode's strange hidden machinery. Up here there's nothing. The trees have dropped their leaves. Nothing moves through the curl-edged, desiccated detritus. No bird song can be heard through the branches. Most birds stop marking territory and mating during a season, and song only attracts predators. No other animal sounds. There are no travelers on the road, though you can tell that the ash is thinner there. People have been by recently. Aside from that, though, even the wind is still. The sun is set, though there's still plenty of light in the sky. The clouds, even this far south, still reflecting the rifting.
Traffic?
Yika asks one of the sentries.
Family-looking bunch about 40 minutes ago, he says.
He keeps his voice appropriately low.
Well-equipped. Maybe 20 people, all ages, all sunsets, traveling north.
That makes everyone look at him. Yika repeats,
north? North.
The sentry, who has the most beautiful, long-lashed eyes, looks back at Yika and shrugs.
Looked like they had a destination in mind.
Huh. She folds her arms, shivering a little, though it's not particularly cold outside. The cold of a fifth season takes months to set in fully. Kastrima Under's just so warm that to someone used to that, Kastrima Over's chilly. Or maybe Yika's just reacting to the starkness of the calm around her. So many silent houses, dead gardens, and ash-occluded pathways where people once walked. You'd been thinking of the surface level of the calm as bait. And it is. A honeypot meant to draw in the desirable and distract the hostile. Yet it was also a real calm once, alive and bright and anything but still.
Well?
Yika takes a deep breath and smiles. But you think her smile is strained. She nods toward the low-hanging ash clouds.
If you need to see this thing, I don't think you're going to have much luck anytime soon.
She's right. The air is a haze of ash, and past the beaded red-tinted clouds, you can't see a damned thing. You step off the porch and look up at the sky anyway, unsure of how to begin. You also aren't sure if you should begin. After all, the first and second times you tried to interact with an obelisk, you almost died. Then there's the fact that Alabaster wants this, when he's the man who destroyed the world. Maybe you shouldn't do anything he asks. He's never hurt you, though. The world has, but not him. Maybe the world deserved to be destroyed, and maybe he's earned a little of your trust after all these years. So you close your eyes and try to still your thoughts. There are sounds to be heard around you, you notice, at last. Faint creaks and pops as the wooden parts of Kastrima over react to the weight of ash or the changing warmth of the air. Several things scuttling among the dried-out stalks of a house green nearby. Rodents are something else small, nothing to worry about. One of the Kastrimans is breathing really loudly for some reason. Warm jitter of the earth beneath your feet. No. Wrong direction. There's actually enough ash in the sky that you can sort of grasp the clouds with your awareness. Ash is powdered rock, after all, but it's not the clouds you want. You grope along them, as you would Earth's strata, not quite sure what you're looking for.
Will this take much longer? Sighs one of the Kastrimans. Why, got a hot date, Yika drawls.
He is insignificant. He is...
Something pulls you sharply west. You jerk and turn to face it, inhaling as you remember a night long ago in a calm called Alia and another obelisk. The amethyst. He didn't need to see it. He needed to face it.
Lines of sight, lines of force.
Yes. And there. Far along the line of your attention, you assess your awareness being drawn towards something heavy and... dark. Dark. So dark. Alabaster said it would be topaz, didn't he? This isn't that. It feels familiar, sort of. Reminds you of the garnet, not the amethyst. Why?
The garnet was broken. Mad. You're not sure why this word occurs to you. But beyond that, it was also more powerful somehow. Though power is too simple a word for what these things contain.
Richness. Strangeness. Darker colors. Deeper potential. But if that's the case... Onyx, you say aloud, opening your eyes. Other obelisks buzz along the periphery of your line of sight, closer, possible. But they don't respond to this near-instinctive call of yours. The dark obelisk is so far away, well past the western coastals, somewhere over the unknown sea. Even flying, it might take months to arrive. But the onyx hears you. You know this the way you once knew your children had heard you, even if they pretended to ignore you. Ponderously it turns. Arcane processes awakening for the first time in an age of the earth, as it does, uttering an assault of sound and vibration that shakes the sea for miles underneath. How do you know this? You're not sensing this. You just know. Then it begins to come. Evil eating earth. You flinch back along the line that leads to yourself. Along the way, something snags your attention, and almost as an afterthought, you call it, too, the topaz. It is lighter, livelier, much closer, and somehow more responsive, perhaps because you perceive a hint of alabaster in its interstices, like a curl of citrus rind added to a savory dish. He's prepped it for you. Then you snap back into yourself and turn to Yika, who's frowning at you. You follow that. She shakes her head slowly, but not in negation. She caught some of it somehow. You can see that in the look on her face. That was... something. I'm not sure what.
Don't reach for either one when they get here. Because you're sure they're coming. Don't reach for any of them. Ever. You're reluctant to say obelisk. Too many stills around, and even if they haven't killed you yet, stills never need to hear that something can make origins even more of a danger than they already are.
what would happen if I did?
It's a question of honest curiosity, not challenge. But some questions are dangerous. You decide to be honest. You would die. I'm not sure how. Actually, you're pretty sure she would spontaneously ignite into a white-hot, screaming column of fire and force, possibly taking all of Kastrima with her. But you're not 100% sure, so you stick to what you know. Those things are like the batteries some equatorial comms use. Shit. Used. You've heard of those? A battery stores energy so you can have electricity, even if the hydro's not flowing or the geo has... Yika looks affronted. Well, she is, Sun said. They invented batteries.
I know what a rusting battery is. First hint of a shake, and you've got acid burns on top of everything else, all for the sake of a bit of stored juice.
She shakes her head. What you're talking about isn't a battery. They were making sugar batteries when I left Eumenes, you say. She's not saying obelisk either. Good, she gets it. Safer than acid and metal, batteries can be made more than one way. But if a battery is too powerful for the circuit you attach it to, you figure that's enough to get the idea across. She shakes her head again, but you think she believes you. As she turns and starts to pace in thought, you notice Lerna. He's been quiet all this time, listening to you and Yika talk. Now he seems deep in thought, and that bothers you. You don't like that Estil is thinking so hard about this. But then, he surprises you. Yika, how old do you think this calm really is? She stops and frowns at him. The other Kastrimans shift as if uncomfortable. Maybe it bothers them, being reminded that they live in a dead civ ruin.
No clue. Why?
He shrugs. I'm just thinking of similarities.
You understand, then. Crystals in Kastrima Under that glow through some means you can't fathom. Crystals that float in the sky by some means you can't fathom. Both mechanisms meant to be used by Origens, and no one else. Stone Eaters showing an inordinate interest in Origens who use either. You glance at Hoa. But Hoa isn't looking at the sky or at you. He's stepped off the porch and has crouched on the ashy ground just off the walkway, staring at something. You follow his gaze and see a small mound in what was once the front yard of the house next door. It looks like just another pile of ash, maybe 3 feet high, but then you notice a tiny, desiccated animal foot poking out of one end. Cat, maybe, or rabbit. There are probably dozens of small carcasses around here buried under the ash. The beginning of the season likely caused a huge die-off. Odd that this carcass seems to have accumulated so much more ash than the ground around it, though.
Too long gone to eat, kid, says one of the men, who's also noticed Hoa and clearly has no idea what the kid is.
Hoa blinks at him and bites his lip with just the perfect degree of unease. He plays the child so well. Then he gets up and comes over to you, and you realize he's not play-acting. Something really has unnerved him.
Other things will eat it, he says to you very softly. We should go.
What? You're not afraid of anything. His jaw tightens, jaw full of diamond teeth, muscles over diamond bones. No wonder he's never let you try to lift him. He must be heavy as marble. But he says,
I'm afraid of things that will hurt you.
And you believe him, because you suddenly realize that's been the commonality of all his strange behavior so far. His willingness to face the Kakuza, which might have been too fast even for your orogeny. His ferocity toward other stone eaters. He's protecting you. So few have ever tried to protect you in your life. It's impulse that makes you lift a hand and stroke it over his weird white hair. He blinks. Something comes into his eyes that is
anything but inhuman. You don't know what to think. This, though, is why you listened to him.
Let's go, you say to Yika and the others. You've done what Alabaster asked. You suspect he won't be displeased by the extra obelisk when you tell him, if he doesn't already know. Now maybe, finally, he'll tell you what the rust is going on.
Before, gather into stable rock for each citizen's one-year supply. 10 rullets of grain, 5 of legume, 1/4 trade at dry fruit, and 1/2 store it in tallow, cheese, or preserved flesh. Multiply by each year of life desired. After, guard upon stable rock with at least 3 strong-backed souls per cache. 1 to guard the cache, 2 to guard the guard.
Tablet 1. On Survival. Verse 4.
3. Shafa. Forgotten. Yes, you are him, too. Or you were until after Maeve. But now, he is someone else.
The force that shatters the Klausu is orogeny applied to air. Orogeny isn't meant to be applied to air, but there's no real reason for it not to work. Cyanide has had practice already using orogeny on water at and since Alia. There are minerals in water, and likewise there are dust particles in air. Air has heat and friction and mass and kinetic potential, same as Earth. The molecules of air are simply farther apart, the atoms shaped differently. Anyhow, the involvement of an obelisk makes all of these details academic.
Shafa knows what's coming the instant he feels the obelisk's pulse.
He is old, old.
Cyanite's guardian.
So old. He knows what Stone Eaters do to powerful Orogens whenever they get the chance. And he knows why it is crucial to keep Orogen's eyes on the ground and not the sky. He has seen what happens when a four-ringer, that's how he still thinks of Cyanide, connects to an obelisk. He does genuinely care about her, you realize? She does not realize. It isn't all about control. She's his little one, and he has protected her in more ways than she knows. The thought of her agonizing death is unbearable to him. This is ironic, considering what happens next. In the moment when Cyanide stiffens and her frame becomes suffused with light, and the air within the Klausu's tiny forward compartment shivers and turns into a nearly solid wall of unstoppable force, Shafa happens to be standing to one side of a hanging bulkhead rather than in front of it. His companion, the guardian who has just killed Cyanite's feral lover, is not so lucky. When the force slams him backward, the bulkhead juts out from the wall at just the right height and angle to shear his head off before giving way itself. Shafa, however, flies backward unobstructed through the Klausu's capacious hold, which is empty, because the ship hasn't been out on a piracy run in a while. There's room enough for its velocity to slow a little, and for the greatest force of Cyanite's blow to move past him. When he finally does hit a bulkhead, it is with merely bone-breaking force and not bone-pulverizing force. And the bulkhead is buckling, crumbling along with the rest of the ship when he hits it. That helps too. Then when jagged, knife-like spikes of bedrock from the ocean floor begin spearing through the explosion of debris, Shafa is lucky again. None of them pierce his body. Cyanide is lost in the obelisk by this point, and lost in the first throes of a grief that will send aftershakes through even Esun's life. Shafa saw her hand on the child's face, covering mouth and nose, pressing. Incomprehensible, did she not know that Shafa would love her son as he loved her? He would lay the boy down gently, so gently, in the wire chair. She is part of something vast and globally powerful now, and Shafa, once the most important person in her world, is beneath her notice. On some level, He is aware of this even as he flies through the storm, and the knowledge leaves a deep burn of hurt in his heart. Then he's in the water and dying. It is difficult to kill a guardian. The many broken bones Shafa has suffered and the damage to his organs would not be enough to do the job in and of themselves. Even drowning wouldn't be a problem under ordinary circumstances. Guardians are different. But they do have limits, and drowning, plus organ failure, plus blunt force trauma is enough to breach them. He realizes this as he tumbles through the water, bouncing off shards of stone and debris from the destroyed ship. He can't tell which way is up, except that one direction seems faintly brighter than the other. But he is being dragged away from this by the swiftly sinking aft end of the ship. He uncurls, hits a rock, recovers, and tries to paddle against the downward current even though one of his arms is now broken. There's nothing in his lungs. The air has been beaten out of him, and he's trying not to inhale water because then he will surely die. He cannot die. He has so much left to do. But he is only human, mostly. And as the terrible pressure grows and spots of blackness encroach on his vision and his whole body grows numb with the weight of the water, he cannot help sucking in a mighty lungful. It hurts. Salt, acid in his chest, fire in his throat, and still no air. On top of everything else, he can bear the rest, has borne worse in his long, awful life. It is suddenly too much for the ordered, careful rationality that has guided and guarded Shafa's mind up to this point. He panics. Guardians must never panic. He knows this. There are good reasons why. He does it anyway, flailing and screaming as he is dragged into the cold dark. He wants to live. This is the first and worst sin for one of his kind. His terror suddenly vanishes. A bad sign. It is replaced a moment later by an anger so powerful that it blots out everything else. He stops screaming and trembles with it. But even as he does so, he knows. This anger is not his own. In his panic, he has opened himself to danger, and the danger that he fears above all others has come striding through the door as if it owns the place already. It says to him, "If you wish to live, that can be arranged." Oh, evil earth. More offers, promises, suggestions, and their rewards. Shafa can have more power. Power enough to fight the current and the pain and the lack of oxygen. He can live for a price. No. No. He knows the price. Better to die than pay it. But it is one thing to resolve to die, quite another to actually carry out that resolve in the midst of dying. Something burns at the back of Shafa's skull. This is a cold burn, not like the fire in his nose and throat and chest. Something there is waking up, warming up, gathering itself, ready for the collapse of his resistance. "We all do what we have to do," comes the seducer's whisper. And this is the same reasoning Shafa has used on himself too many times over the centuries, justifying too many atrocities. One does what one must for duty, for life. It's enough. The cold presence takes him. Power suffuses his limbs. In just a few suddenly restarted heartbeats, the broken bones have knitted and the organs have resumed their traditional function, albeit with a few workarounds for the lack of oxygen. He twists in the water and begins to swim, sensing the direction he must go. Not up, not anymore. Suddenly he finds oxygen in the water that he is breathing. He has no gills, yet his alveoli suddenly absorb more than they should be able to. It's only a little oxygen, though, not even enough to feed his body properly. Cells die, especially in a very particular part of his brain. He is aware of this horribly. He is aware of the slow death of all that makes him Shafa. But the price must be paid. He fights it, of course. The anger tries to drive him forward, keep him underwater. but he knows that everything of him will die if he does. So he swims forward, but also upward, squinting through the murk at the light. It takes a long, dying time. But at least some of the rage within him is his own. Fury that he has been forced into this position, rage at himself for succumbing. And that keeps him at it, even as the tingling sets into his hands, his feet. But he reaches the surface, breaches it, concentrates hard on not panicking while he vomits up water, coughs out more, and finally sucks in air. It hurts so much. Still, with the first inhalation, the dying stops. His brain and limbs get what they need. There are still spots in his vision, still that awful coldness at the back of his head, but he is Shafa. Shafa. He holds on to this, digs in claws and snarls away the encroaching cold. Fire under earth. He's still Shafa, and he will not let himself forget this. He loses so much else, though. Understand, the Shafa that we have known thus far, the Shafa whom Demaya learned to fear and Sinite learned to defy, is now dead. What remains is a man with a habit of smiling, a warped paternal instinct, and a rage that is not wholly his own, driving everything he does from this point on. Perhaps you will mourn the Shafa who is lost. It's all right if you do. He was part of you once. He resumes swimming. After about 7 hours, this is the strength his memories have bought him. He sees the still-smoking cone of Alia against the horizon. It's a longer distance than straight to shore, but he adjusts his direction to swim toward it. There will be help there. He knows, somehow. It is well past sunset now, fully dark. The water is cold, and he's thirsty, and he hurts. Thankfully, none of the monsters of the deep attack him. The only real threat he faces is his own will, and the question of whether it will falter in the battle against the sea, or against the cold rage eating his mind. It does not help that he is alone, save for the indifferent stars, and the obelisk. He sees it once when he glances back, a wavering, now colorless shape against the sparkling night sky. It looks no farther away than when he first noticed it from the deck of the ship, and ignored it in favor of focusing on his quarry. He should have paid closer attention. Studied it to see if it was approaching. Remember that even a four-ringer can be a threat under the right circumstances, and he frowns, pausing for a moment to float on his back. This is dangerous. Fatigue immediately begins to set in. The power that sustains him can do only so much. He stares at the obelisk. A four-ringer. Who? He tries to remember. There was someone important. No, he is Shafa. That is all that is important. He resumes swimming. Near dawn, he feels gritty black sand under his feet. He stumbles up out of the water, alien to himself and the movement of limbs on land, half crawling. The surf recedes behind him. There's a tree ahead. He collapses upon its roots and does something that resembles sleep. It's closer to a coma. When he wakes, the sun's up and he is afire with pain of every kind. Sore lungs, aching limbs, throbbing unhealed fractures in his non-essential bones. A dry throat, cracking skin, and another deeper ache. He groans and something shadows his face.
You all right?
Asks a voice that sounds like he feels. Rough, dry, low. He peels his eyes open to see an old man crouching before him. The man's an East Coaster, thin and weathered, most of his curly white hair gone except a fringe round the back of his head. When Shafa looks around, he sees that they are in a small, tree-shadowed cove. The old man's rowboat has been pulled onto the shore not far away. A fishing rod pokes out of it. The trees of the cove are all dead, and the sand beneath Shafa blows with ash. They're still very close to the volcano that was Alia. How did he get here? He remembers swimming. Why was he in the water? That part is gone.
I...
Shafa begins and chokes on his own dry, swollen tongue. The old man helps him sit up, then offers him an open canteen. Brackish, leather-flavored water never tasted so sweet. The old man pulls it away after a few swallows, which Shafa knows is wise, but he still groans and reaches after the canteen once. Only once, though. He is strong enough not to beg. The emptiness inside him is not just thirst. He tries to focus.
I'm...
This time speaking is easier.
I don't know if I'm all right. Shipwreck?
The old man cranes his neck to look around. In the near distance, very visible, is the ridge of knife-like stones that Cyanite raised from the pirate's island all the way to the mainland.
Were you out there? What was that, some sort of shake?
It seems impossible that the old man does not know. But Shafa has always been amazed at how little ordinary people understand about the world. Always? Has he always been so amazed? Really?
Raga,
he says, too tired to manage the three syllables of the non-vulgar word for their kind. It's enough. The old man's face hardens.
Filthy, earth-spawned beasts. That's why they have to be drowned as babes.
He shakes his head and focuses on Shafa.
You're too big for me to lift, and dragging will hurt. Think you can get up?
With help, Shafa does manage to rise and stagger to the old man's rowboat. He sits, shivering in the prow, while the old man rows them away from the cove, heading south along the coast. Some of why he's shivering is cold. His clothes are still wet where he was lying down. And some of it is lingering shock. Some of it, however, is something entirely else.
Demaya.
With great effort, he remembers this name. And an impression. A small, frightened mid-ladder girl, superimposed over a tall, defiant mid-ladder woman. Love and fear in her eyes. Sorrow in his heart. He has hurt her. He needs to find her. But when he reaches for the sense of her that should be embedded in his mind, there is nothing. She is gone, along with everything else. The old man chatters at him through the whole ride. He is Litz Strongback Metter, and Metter is a little fishing town a few miles south of Alia. They've been debating whether to move since that whole mess with Alia happened, but then suddenly the volcano went dormant. So maybe the evil Earth isn't out to get them after all, or at least not this time. He's got two children, one stupid and the other selfish, and three grandkids, all from the stupid one, and hopefully not too stupid themselves. They don't have much. Metter's just another coaster calm. Can't even afford a proper wall instead of a bunch of trees and sticks. But folks gotta do what folks gotta do. You know how it is. Everyone will take good care of you, don't you worry.
What is your name?
The old man asks amid the prattle, and Shafa tells him. The man asks for more names than this. But Shafa has only the one.
What were you doing out there?
The silence inside Shafa yawns in answer. The village is an especially precarious one, in that it is half on shore and half on the water, houseboats and stilt houses connected by jetties and piers. People gather round Shafa when Litz helps him onto a pier. Hands touch him and he flinches. But they mean to help. It is not their fault that there's so little in them of what he needs that they feel wrong. They push him, guide him. He is beneath a cold shower of fresh water, and then he is put into short pants and a homespun sleeveless shirt. When he lifts his hair while washing it, they marvel at the scar on his neck, thick and stitched, and vanishing into his hairline. He wonders at it himself. They puzzle over his clothing, so faded by sun and salt water that it has lost nearly all color. It looks brownish-gray. He remembers that it should be burgundy, but not why. More water, the good kind. This time he can drink his fill. He eats a little, then he sleeps for hours, with incessant angry whispering in the back of his mind. When Shaf awakes, it's late in the night, and there's a little boy standing in front of his bed. The lantern's wick has been turned down low, but it's bright enough in the room that Shafa can see his old clothing, now washed and dry, in the boy's hands. The boy has turned one pocket inside out. There, alone on the whole garment, has it retained something of its original color. Burgundy. Shafa pushes himself up on one elbow. Something about the boy, perhaps.
Hello?
The boy looks so much like Litz that he needs only a few decades of weathering and less hair to be the old man's twin. But there is a desperate hope in the boy's eyes that would be completely out of place in Litz's. Litz knows his place in the world. This boy, who is maybe 11 or 12, old enough to be confirmed by his calm, something has unmoored him. And Shafa thinks he knows what.
This is yours, the boy says, holding up the garment. Yes.
You're a guardian? Fleeting, almost memory.
What is that?
The boy looks as confused as Shafa feels. He takes a step closer to the bed and stops.
Come closer. Closer.
They said you didn't remember things. You're lucky to be alive.
The boy licks his lips, uncertain.
Guardians. Guard. Guard what?
Incredulity washes the fear from the boy. He steps closer still.
Origins? I mean, you guard people from them, so they don't hurt anyone. And you guard them from people, too. That's what the stories say.
Shafa pushes himself to sit up, letting his legs dangle over the edge of the bed. The pain of his injuries is nearly gone, his flesh repaired at a faster rate than normal by the angry power within him. He feels well, in fact. Except for one thing.
Guard. Origins, he says thoughtfully. Do I?
The boy laughs a little, though his smile fades quickly. He's very afraid for some reason, though not of Shafa.
People kill origins, the boy says softly. When they find them. Unless they're with a guardian. Do they?
Seems uncivilized of them, but then he remembers the ridge of spiky stones across the ocean and his utter conviction that it was the work of an origin.
That's why they have to be drowned as babes, Litz had said. Missed one,
Shafa thinks, then has to fight hysterical laughter.
I don't want to hurt anyone, the boy is saying. I will, one day, without training. I almost did when that volcano was doing things. It was so hard not to. If you had, it would have killed you and possibly many other people,
Shafa says. Then he blinks.
How does he know that?
A hot spot is far too volatile for you to quell safely.
The boy's eyes alight.
You do know.
He comes forward, sinks to a crouch beside Shafa's knee. He whispers,
please, help me. I thank my mother. She saw me when the volcano. I tried to act like normal, and I couldn't. I think she knows. If she tells my grandfather.
He inhales suddenly, sharply, as if he's gasping for air. He's holding back a sob, but the movement looks the same. Shafa knows how it feels to drown. He reaches out and strokes the boy's dense cloud of hair, crown to nape, and lets his fingers linger at the nape.
There's something I have to do, Shafa says,
because there is. The anger and whispers within him have a purpose after all. And this has become his purpose. Gather them, train them,
Make them the weapons they are meant to be. If I take you with me, we must travel far from here. You'll never see your family again.
The boy looks away, his expression turning bitter.
They'd kill me if they knew. Yes.
Shafa presses very gently and draws the first measure of something from the boy. What? He cannot remember what it is called. Perhaps it has no name. All that matters is that it exists and he needs it. With it, he knows somehow, he can hold on more tightly to the tattered remnants of who he is, was. So he takes, and the first draft of it is like a sudden sweet wash of fresh water amid gallons of burning salt. He yearns to drink it all, reaches for the rest as thirstily as he saw it lit his canteen, though he forces himself to let go for the same reason. He can endure on what he has now, if he's patient. The boy will have more for him later.
Yes, his thoughts are clearer now. Easier to think around the whispers. He needs this boy and others like him. He must go forth and find them, and with their help, he can make it to... Well, not everything is clear. Some things will never come back. He'll make do.
The boy is searching his face.
While Shafa has been trying to put together the fragments of his identity, the boy has been wrestling with his future. They are made for each other.
I'll go with you, the boy says, having apparently spent the past minute thinking he has a choice.
Anywhere. I don't want to hurt anyone. I don't want to die.
For the first time since a moment on a ship a few days before, when he was a different person, Shafa smiles. He strokes the boy's head again.
You have a good soul. I'll help you all I can.
The boy's tension dissolves at once. Tears wet his eyes.
Go and gather some things to travel. I'll speak with your parents.
These words fall from his mouth naturally, easily. He has said them before, though he doesn't remember when. He remembers, though, that sometimes things don't go as well as he says they will. The boy whispers his thanks, grabs Shafa's knee, and tries to squeeze that thanks into him, then trots away. Shafa pushes himself slowly to his feet. The boy has left the faded uniform behind, so Shafa pulls this on again, his fingers remembering how the seams should lie. There should be a cloak, too, but that is gone. He can't remember where. When he steps forward, a mirror on the side of the room catches his eye, and he stops. Shivers. Not in pleasure this time. It is wrong. It is so wrong. His hair hangs lank and dry after the sun and salt's ravaging. It should be black and glossy, and instead it is dull and wispy, burnt. The uniform hangs off him, for he has spent some of the substance of his own body as fuel in the push to reach shore. The uniform's colors are also wrong, and there is no reassurance in it of who he was, who he should be. And his eyes? Evil earth, he thinks, staring at the icy near white of them. He did not know his eyes looked like this. There is a creak on the floorboards near the door, and his alien eyes shift to one side. The boy's mother stands there, blinking in the light of the lantern she holds. Shafa, she says. I thought I heard you up. An eight? That must be the boy's name.
He came to bring me these.
Shafa touches his clothing. The woman comes into the room.
Huh, she says.
Now that it's all wrung out and dry, it looks like a uniform. Shafa nods.
I've learned something new of myself. I'm a guardian.
Her eyes widen. Truly. There's suspicion in her gaze. An eight has been bothering you.
It was no bother.
Shafa smiles to reassure her. For some reason, the woman's frown twitches and deepens.
Oh, well.
He has forgotten how to charm people, too. He turns and goes over to her, and she falls back a step at his approach. He stops, amused by her fear.
He, too, has learned something of himself. I'll be taking him away now.
The woman's eyes widen. Her mouth works in silence for a moment, then she sets her jaw.
I knew it. Did you?
I didn't want to. She swallows, her hand tightening. The little lantern flame wavers with whatever emotion flashes through her.
Don't take him, please.
Shafa tilts his head.
Why not?
It would kill his father.
Not his grandfather?
Shafa takes a step closer. Closer.
Not his uncles and aunts and cousins? Not you?
She twitches again. I don't know how I feel right now. She shakes her head.
Poor, poor thing,
Shafa says softly. This compassion is automatic, too. He feels the sorrow deeply.
But will you protect him from them, if I do not take him?
What? She looks at Shafa in surprise and alarm. Can this truly have never occurred to her? Apparently not.
Protect him?
That she asks this, Shafa understands, is the proof that she is inadequate to the task. So he sighs and reaches up, as if to put a hand on her shoulder, and shakes his head as if to convey regret. She relaxes minutely, and does not notice when his hand instead curves around her neck. His fingers settle into place, and she stiffens at once.
What?
Then she falls down, dead. Shafa blinks as she falls to the floor. For a moment he is confused. Was that supposed to happen? And then his own thoughts freshened further by the dollop of something that she has given him. Such a tiny amount of it relative to what Eights possessed. He understands. This thing is only safe to do with Origens, who have more than enough to share. The woman must have been a still. But Shafa feels better. In fact, take more, whispers the rage at the back of his mind. Take the others. They threaten the boy, which threatens you.
Yes, that seems wise.
So Shafa rises and moves through the quiet, dark house, touching each member of Aitz's family and devouring a piece of them. Most of them do not wake. The stupid son gives more than the rest, almost an origin, almost a guardian. Litz gives the least, perhaps because he is old, or perhaps because he is awake and fighting against the hand Shafa has clamped over his mouth and nose. He's trying to stab Shafa with a fish knife pulled from under his pillow. What a pity that he must suffer such fear. Shafa twists Litz's head around sharply to get at the nape of his neck. There's a snapping sound as he does this, which he doesn't even notice, until the flow of something out of Litz goes soft and dead and useless. Ah, yes. Belatedly, Shafa remembers that it does not work on the dead. He'll be more careful in the future. But it is so much better now that the taut ache inside him is gone still. He feels not whole, never that, again. But when there is so much of another presence inside him, even a little regained ground is a blessing.
I am Shafa, guardian. Warrant,
he murmurs, blinking as the last part finally comes to him. What calm is warrant? He cannot remember. He is glad to have the name, regardless.
I have done only what was necessary. Only what is best for the world.
The words feel right, yes. He has needed the sense of purpose which now sits like lead at the back of his brain. Amazing that he did not have it before. Now, though.
Now, I have work to do.
Eights finds him in the living room. The boy's breathless, excited, carrying a small satchel. I heard you and Mama talking. Did you tell her? Shafa crouches to be on eye level with him, taking him by the shoulders.
Yes. She said she didn't know how she felt, and then she said nothing more.
Aitz's face crumples. He glances toward the corridor that leads to the adults' rooms in the house. Everyone down that corridor is dead. The doors are closed and quiet. Shafa has left Aitz's siblings and cousins alive, however, because he is not a complete monster. "Can I say goodbye to her?" Aitz asks softly.
"I think that would be dangerous,"
Shafa says. He means it. He doesn't want to have to kill the boy yet.
"These things are best done cleanly. Come, you have me now, and I will never leave you."
The boy blinks at this and straightens a little, then nods shakily. He's old for such words to have the power on him that they do. They work, Shafa suspects, because Aitz has spent the past few months living in terror of his family. It is nothing to play on such a lonely, weary state of mind. It isn't even a lie. They leave the half-dead house behind. Shafa knows that he should take the boy somewhere. Somewhere with obsidian walls and gilded bars. A place that will die in a cataclysm of fire in 10 years. So perhaps it is good that he is too damaged to remember this location. In any case, the angry whispers have begun steering him in a different direction. Somewhere south, where he has work to do. He puts his hand on Aitz's shoulder to comfort the boy, or perhaps to comfort himself. Together they walk into the pre-dawn dark.
"Don't be fooled. The guardians are much, much older than old sons, and they do not work for us." Last recorded words of Emperor Mushtati, prior to his execution.
4. You are challenged. You are tired after calling the obelisk. When you get back to your room and stretch out for half a moment on the bare pallet that came with the apartment, you fall asleep so fast you don't even realize you're doing it. In the dead of the night, or so your body clock says, since the glowing walls haven't changed, your eyes blink open and it's like only a moment has passed. But Hoa is curled beside you, apparently actually sleeping for once, and you can hear Tonki snoring faintly in the room next door, and you feel much better than you did, if hungry. Well rested for perhaps the first time in weeks. The hunger spurs you up and into the apartment's living room. There's a small hempen satchel on the table, which Tonki must have acquired, partially open, to reveal mushrooms and a small pile of dried beans and other cash food. That's right. As accepted members of Kastrima, you now get a share of the comm's stores. None of it is the kind of food you can just eat for a snack, except maybe the mushrooms. But you've never seen those before, and some varieties of mushrooms need to be cooked to be edible. You're tempted, but is Kastrima the sort of comm that would give dangerous foodstuffs to newcomers without warning them? Right. You fetch your runny sack, rummage in it for the remaining provisions you brought to Kastrima with you, and make a meal out of dried oranges, cash bread crusts, and a lump of bad-tasting jerky that you traded for at the last comm you passed, and which you suspect is hydropipe rat meat. Food is that which nourishes, the lorists say. You've just choked the jerky down, and are sitting there sleepily pondering how merely summoning an obelisk took so much out of you. As if anything regarding the obelisks can be described with the adjective merely, when you become aware of a high rhythmic scraping sound outside. You dismiss it immediately. Nothing about this calm makes sense. It will probably take you weeks, if not months, to get used to its peculiar sounds. Months. Are you giving up on Nasun so easily? So you ignore the sound, even as it grows louder and closer, and you keep yawning, and you're about to get up and head back to bed when it belatedly dawns on you that what you're hearing is screaming. Frowning, you go to the door of the apartment, pulling open the thin curtain. You're not particularly concerned. Your sesapine haven't even twitched, And anyway, if there's ever a shakedown here in Kostrima Under, everyone's dead, no matter how quickly they leave their homes. Outside, there are lots of people up and about. A woman passes right by your door, carrying a big basket of the same mushrooms you almost ate. She nods at you distractedly as you come out, then almost loses her load as she tries to turn toward the noise and nearly bumps into a man pushing a covered wheeled bin that stinks to the sky and is probably from the latrines. In a calm with no functional day-night cycle, Kostrima effectively never sleeps. And you know they have 6 work shifts instead of the usual 3 because you've been put on one. It won't start till midday, or 12 bell, as the Kostrima folk say, when you're supposed to look for some woman named Artith near the forge. And none of this is relevant, because through the scatter and jut of Kostrima's crystals, you can see a small cluster of people coming into the big rectangular tunnel mouth that serves as the entrance to the geode. They're running, and they're carrying another person who's doing all the screaming. Even then, you're tempted to ignore it and go back to sleep. It's a season. People die. There's nothing you can do about it. These aren't even your people. There's no reason for you to care. Then someone shouts, "Lerna!" And the tone of it is so panicked that you twitch. You can see the squat gray crystal that houses Lerna's apartment from your balcony, 3 crystals away and a little below your own. His door curtain jerks open, and he hurries out, shrugging on a shirt as he runs down the nearest set of steps, heading for the infirmary where the cluster of running folk seems to be going as well. For reasons that you cannot name, you glance back at your own apartment doorway. Tonki, who sleeps like petrified wood, hasn't come out, but Hoa is there, statue still and watching you. Something about his expression makes you frown. He doesn't seem to be able to do the emotionless stone face of his kin, maybe because he doesn't have a face of actual stone. Regardless, the first thing you interpret of his expression is pity. You're out of the apartment and running for the ground level in the next breath, almost before you've thought about it. You think as you run. The pity of a disguised stone eater has galvanized you as the screams of a fellow human being haven't. Such a monster you are. Kostrima is as frustratingly confusing as always, but this time you're aided by the fact that other people have started running along the bridges and walkways in the direction of the trouble, so you can just go with the flow. By the time you get there, a small crowd has formed around the infirmary, most of the people milling about in curiosity or concern or anxiety. Lerna and the cluster of people carrying their injured companion have gone inside, and the awful screech is obvious now for what it is, the throat-tearing howl of someone in appalling pain, pain beyond bearing, who nevertheless is somehow forced to bear it. It is not an intentional thing that you start pushing forward to get inside. You know nothing about giving medical care, but you do know pain. To your surprise, though, people glance at you in annoyance, then blink and shift aside. You notice those who look blank being pulled aside for quick whispers by those whose eyes have widened.
Oh-ho. Kostrima has been talking about you. Then you're inside the infirmary, and you nearly get knocked down by a sunset woman running past with some sort of syringe in her hands. Can't be safe to do that. You follow her over to an infirmary bed where 6 people hold down the person doing the screaming. You get a look at the person's face when one of them shifts aside. No one you know. Just another mid-ladder man who has clearly been topside to judge by the gray layer of ash on his skin and clothing and hair. The woman with the syringe shoulders aside someone else and ostensibly administers the syringe's contents. A moment later, the man shudders all over and his mouth begins to close. His scream dies off slowly. 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 He jerks once mightily. His holders all shift with the strength of his effort. Then at last, mercifully, he subsides into unconsciousness. The silence almost reverberates,
Lerna and the Sunset Healer keep moving, though the people who have been holding the man down draw back and look at each other, as if asking what to do now. In the now silent